The Bookmark on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. I'd like to welcome to the program today Pamela Wexler. She joins us on the telephone out in Southern California. Hello, Pam.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. I see you've got a new book out, and it's a very Bostonian production. Tell us about yourself. You must be from Boston.
I am. I lived in Boston for most of my life. I went to school there, and I worked as a prosecutor in the DA's office and the Attorney General's office there. And then I moved to Washington, D.C., and I worked for the Justice Department.
Your new crime novel is called The Fens, and I understand this is the third book that you've written featuring a protagonist who is a chief homicide prosecutor in Boston named Abby Endicott. Is that right? This is the third one?
That's right. It's a series. The Fens is the third in the series, and each book follows Abby Endicott's personal and professional life. Each book is a different murder case. The Fens is about the star catcher for the Red Sox goes missing on opening day, and Abby catches the case. So, that's what The Fens is about.
And for those of us who are Red Sox fans, we know what the Fens are.
The Fens is an area near Fenway Park, a marshy area, and it's also a park where people go for recreational reasons. But all of the books are named after locations in Boston, and they all sort of have a double meaning, which appeals to me. The first one's called Mission Hill, the second one's called The Graves, and the third one's called The Fens.
The Graves is a location in Boston?
The Graves is an island in Boston Harbor. Yes.
Oh, see, I didn't know that.
Yes.
I only lived there for one summer, so I knew the Fens.
It's a great city. I really like it. It's small, and yet there's a lot going on, and there's a lot to draw from in terms of politics and sports and colleges and universities. It's got a rich history. So it was a very fertile ground for writing books about.
And you timed this to come out right around the beginning of baseball season.
That I did not time. That was just a coincidence. But yes, it did come out right around baseball opening.
And the Red Sox are central in this story. But I was fascinated by the fact that we actually have Red Sox players who are involved in pretty bad crimes. This was kind of shocking to me as a Red Sox fan.
Well, of course, it's completely fictional. I sort of started with the idea of what if Fenway Park was a crime scene. When I went to law school, I lived right near Fenway Park. I went to Boston University Law School, and so I would walk by there a lot. And I thought, wouldn't this be an interesting place to set a crime scene, which is a big part of the book.
Okay, I have not read the first two books, and I'm sure that the story is progressing as we're moving along. Tell us about your protagonist. Who is she? Where does she come from? What's her story?
She's a woman who's living in two very different worlds. That was sort of the starting point for me. She comes from a very wealthy Boston Brahmin family on Beacon Hill, which is a very small but exclusive part of Boston. And then she chooses to spend her time in this world of tragedy and danger, and she sort of fights the good fight when she could really be doing anything. She's very well educated, and she has a lot of resources and connections, but this is what she chooses to do, and she's really good at it.
I only read this new book, but I'm guessing that it's possible to read them out of order. I totally understood what was going on just by the way that you wrote it, and one gets the impression that she's kind of being disowned by her parents as this book opens.
Right. In Mission Hill, the first book, a colleague of hers is murdered by someone he's prosecuting, and it sort of highlights the danger of the job and is drawn from a real situation from Boston. And her family didn't really approve of what she was doing in the first place. They thought she'd be better suited in a law firm or something more befitting her background. But then when this murder happens, they draw the line and cut off her trust fund, so she actually has to live off of her salary, which is a big shock to her.
Pamela Wexler joins me. Her new novel is The Fens. Yeah, Abby's having a hard time because she's got expensive tastes, particularly in clothing.
Yes, she does. She grew up a certain way, and she has a certain style, and money was never really an issue for her, and now it is. By book three, she's had to give up her condo in the Back Bay and, reheel her shoes and carry on. As best she can.
She works very closely with another person. Tell us about her cohort.
She works with a homicide detective who is her favorite detective, and so she tries to get the cases that he's involved with. And they spend a lot of time together, and they deal with a lot of really dark things together. So they have formed a bond that threatens her boyfriend and the detective's wife, an emotional bond. And there's also a spark of physical attraction sort of lurking in the background.
And as this story opens, her boyfriend is dealing with his own situation involving the police. Can we talk about that at all?
Sure. Her boyfriend is African-American, and she is a Caucasian. And Boston has, as do a lot of cities, but Boston particularly has a history of racism in a lot of different areas. And so when he is walking down the street with Abby and stopped, it's the beginning of a storyline involving racism.
And this storyline, unfortunately, becomes entangled in the prosecution case later on. And, of course, we're not going to talk about that. But I kept getting flashes on the O.J. trial and Mark Furman.
Well, there's a lot that I drew from. The incident itself actually happened in a very similar manner to a friend of mine, who is a judge. And since Ty was walking with a prosecutor, I found it interesting to see how they handle the situation and sort of turn it around. But it impacts Abby's case ultimately. So it impacts both her personal life and this case that she ends up catching.
Okay, set the scene. What can you tell us without giving away too much?
In terms of the plot of the book?
Yes.
So opening day for the Red Sox, it's a big day in Boston. People skip work and go. Boston is a huge sports city for all of the different teams, but the Fenway Park is right in Boston itself. And the star catcher goes missing, and Abby picks up the case, and it takes a lot of twists and turns. Another catcher goes missing, and a player on the team becomes a suspect. And so the first half of the book is a whodunit, and the second half of the book is how we're going to get them. So the second half deals with the complications of a murder trial, but particularly a murder trial involving a celebrity, a beloved celebrity in the city of Boston. And so the challenge becomes, can she get a conviction?
Yes, the second half is the courtroom drama, and I find that when former prosecutors write courtroom dramas, the Alifair Burks and the Linda Fairsteins and the Pam Wexlers really know what they're talking about.
Well, I definitely drew from my own experience and from watching try cases when I was a prosecutor. So it makes it easier in terms of having real things to draw on. I also worked for the Law and Order shows for a while, and that was sort of where I got the idea of doing the half of the book would be the investigation and the other half would be the trial.
I kept flashing on Adam in the early Law and Orders whenever she would have a conversation with her boss.
Right. Yes, I definitely drew from that because it's real. So, you know, the Law and Orders felt very real, and I wanted the books to feel very real as well.
That show went on forever, that first Law and Order. When did you get involved?
I got involved. I was working for the Justice Department, and I had a case out in Los Angeles, and I had written a couple of spec scripts and gotten an agent. And when I was out here for a grand jury investigation, that the agent called and said there was a new Law and Order coming, and the showrunner wanted to meet with me. So I drove from the grand jury in downtown L.A. to the Universal Studios lot.
Huh.
And met with the showrunner and talked about becoming a legal consultant. It was like maybe 15 years ago,
uh-huh.
12 years ago.
Okay.
And so I took a job. I quit my job with Justice and moved out to L.A. and took a job with a show called Law & Order Trial by Jury, which only lasted 13 episodes. So I had sort of uprooted my entire life, and then the show got canceled, and it became a, uh-oh, now what am I going to do?
That was a bold move on your part.
It was a move that I was really excited to make.
Uh-huh.
A lot of people thought it was a little crazy, and it probably was, but it was something I really wanted to do, and so I did.
Didn't you then go back to prosecuting for a while?
I did. I was out in L.A. for about 7 years, and then I moved back to Boston for my mom got sick, and I moved back to deal with family stuff. And so I took a job in the DA's office again for 2 years. And while I was there, I was still in touch with people in L.A., and I was helping consult on some pilots and other things. And this movie came to town called The Judge.
Uh-huh.
It was filmed in Boston, and it was starring Robert Downey Jr. and Robert Duvall, and Billy Bob Thornton played the role of the prosecutor, and he and I talked a lot about some of the experiences that I'd had and the emotional experiences that I'd had when I was a prosecutor, and he suggested that I write a book, a novel. And Billy Bob Thornton is an Academy Award winning writer. And so I thought, well, I should do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I signed up for some classes. I quit my job in the DA's office again, and signed up for some classes at a place called Grub Street in Boston, which is a writing community, and wrote Mission Hill, which was the first book. Ended up getting a 3-book deal. And The Fens is the third in that deal.
You mentioned that when you and Billy Bob were conversing, that you talked about some of the emotional things that you had gone through as a prosecutor. What kind of things were those?
Well, I had written a short story about sort of starting out, and it became the starting point for Mission Hill, about this thing that I used to do. Every night, it was sort of a comforting thing. Before I went to sleep, I would count all of the people that I had prosecuted for murder. It sort of chronologically and remind myself a little bit about each case. The theory being they remember me, so I have to remember them. Because being a prosecutor it's scary sometimes, particularly being a homicide prosecutor, particularly being a homicide prosecutor, when one of my colleagues was murdered by someone he was prosecuting. So, you know, it takes a toll on you.
That fictional storyline was based on something that really happened.
That's right.
Hmm. Well, yeah, they say a lot of authors live it. Sounds like you did.
Right. Well, it was a fictionalized version of what happened.
Sure.
But that's sort of, that was the starting point, and that was the emotional starting point as well.
I find former prosecutors are really good on the courtroom stuff when they write novels, and I find that former reporters like Michael Connelly or John Sanford are really good on the action.
Yep.
How do you do the action? How do you get into that mode to do the action scenes?
Well, I've spent a lot of time with detectives, and in Boston, by statute, the DA has ultimate authority over a murder case. So we would actually respond to the crime scenes and really be an integral part of the investigation. So it was also a familiar, even though I was not out, chasing down people and being a detective, I had some firsthand experience with the investigative aspect to a case.
Hmm. Well, I see a lot of former lawyers doing very well writing novels. I see Lisa Scottolini's new novel is really selling like crazy, and I always like to see that transition being made so well. Do you plan to keep doing this, writing novels?
I'm enjoying it. I certainly am. Right now, I am a television writer again. I'm writing on a television show called Bull, which is a legal drama on CBS. So that's my focus right now, but I hope to write more novels.
I imagine writing screenplays is all-consuming.
There was a period of time when I was doing both. I was finishing The Fens and working on a show, and it was hard. It was hard going from one to the other, and writing for TV is more than a full-time job, so it was a time challenge.
My guest is Pamela Wexler. Her new novel is The Fens. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. And as a baseball fan, I loved reading this, but when you mentioned the word steroids, that was upsetting to me.
Well, I tried to draw from some real-life situations, not involving anyone in particular, but the book touches on steroids, and it touches on CTE, and it touches on some, on racism and just some very real issues that are going on right now.
Some of our listeners are scratching their heads. What is CTE, they're thinking?
That is the brain damage from repetitive trauma to the head. That is a big topic in football right now.
Uh-huh.
But it's also in boxing and...
even soccer.
Even soccer,
mm-hmm.
Yep. So I sort of brought it to the baseball arena.
You have a defense attorney in this story who I loved, and I'm sure he's a classic encapsulation of numerous defense attorneys that you've encountered. What a slick fellow. He's a very expensive lawyer, isn't he?
He's a very expensive lawyer, and a contrast to the resources that are available in the DA's office. I know that people think the government has infinite supply of resources, but the reality is, in the DA's office at least, they don't. And so Abby came up against, a very wealthy client with a very expensive lawyer who had a lot of people and power at his disposal.
Hard to keep current with any kind of book these days, particularly if you're writing about the presidency. But in your book, I noticed, gosh, I'll bet she's upset that they already changed the name of Yawkey Way since the book went to print.
A lot of things were actually real about what ended up happening. Yeah, I did notice that they changed the name of Yawkey Way.
I had to chuckle because a lot of this happens at the ballpark. And we also have this reporter. I take it that you've dealt with a lot of reporters over the years, and the relationship between prosecutors and reporters can sometimes be slightly adversarial, I take it.
It can be adversarial, or it can be, you know, mutually beneficial in some instances where you can – I didn't, but the DA can leak information or not as he sees fit, and the reporter gets the exclusive, and, you know, there's a lot that happens behind the scenes between the lawyers and the reporters. So I try to show that in the books, yeah. I actually started out as a photojournalist for some local newspapers in Boston.
Oh.
I have a particular interest in journalism.
I see. Your secret comes out. During the brief summer I lived in Boston, I lived right on the border of Brookline and Brighton, just behind Cleveland Circle. And I have fond memories of taking the train down Commonwealth Avenue and going, seeing the Sitgo sign. And yeah, that's how I became a Red Sox fan. That's how I became cursed.
Well, the Red Sox got good.
You're right.
When I was growing up, it was just a disaster.
You're right. It finally paid off.
Right.
After all that
exactly.
suffering.
Exactly.
My dad had encouraged me to be a Cubs fan, and I knew that was hopeless.
Well, and my dad confessed very late in life that he was a Yankees fan.
Ooh.
That was shocking to all of us in the family.
Where was he from?
He grew up in New York.
Oh, well, that explains
it. But he spent most of his life in Boston, you know, from college on, so... it was a bit of a shock, because he used to take us to Fenway Park all the time.
Well, it's the kind of thing he wouldn't admit, I'm sure,
or
talk about.
No, he would not.
Oh, my. Is there another novel in progress? Are you going to keep this series going? Now, you said you had a 3-book deal. This is the 3rd book. What's the status? Am I allowed to ask you?
You can ask. I don't know the answer. I do not have another book in the works. I left it so that there could be more. But I'm just not sure yet.
So you don't have something in the drawer, just kind of...
I don't. I don't. I'm working on my next Bull script right now.
Was it hard for you, after writing the first novel, to decide to write a second one?
Well, when I wrote the first one and then shopped it around, I wrote the first one as though it could be a part of a series or it could just be a standalone. And then, you know, once I got the offer to do 3 books, I was really excited, but it was a little daunting because the agreement was a book a year, which is a pretty fast pace. So, you know, I had to get moving on the next one very quickly.
Well, I think some people work best under deadline pressure, and I'm sure with a TV show you're accustomed to that.
Yes, and with being a prosecutor. You know, there are deadlines and there's pressure and the stakes are high and you just power through it. So, yeah.
Well, years ago, we had Daniel Petrocelli on the program, who was the attorney that won the civil suit against O.J.
Uh-huh.
And he had written a book about it. And I kept flashing on O.J. during your story. I don't know if it's because these were celebrities, this guy who goes on trial. He's really good at manipulating the jury and manipulating the audience, and I kind of got the feeling O.J. was like that.
Well, and it's also the athlete, the celebrity athlete. But it really – O.J. was not really in my mind when I was writing it. There was another big case in Boston involving a football player accused of murder, Aaron Hernandez, and that's what inspired me to write about an athlete. It obviously wasn't the same case, but I drew a little bit from that.
This is the New England Patriots player that's dead now, right?
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
That's right.
Yeah, that was pretty outrageous. I was going – they sent out a press packet. I don't know if your publisher shows you the press packets they send out. Sometimes I have been amazed to see an author grab the press packet and say, I've never seen this material.
I've never seen whatever it is you got.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to let you know that they'd included an interview that you did for your second book with something called Dead Darlings. It must be it must be a blog. Anyway, you had mentioned in that interview that you were fascinated with the fake Rockefeller case, and I was too.
Well, I've always been interested in people who lead double lives. You know, you think they're somebody, and it turns out that they're somebody completely different. And the Rockefeller case, where that was tried in Boston a while ago, someone who was posing as a member of the Rockefeller family and then was discovered and had committed a crime. He kidnapped his child and ultimately was accused of another unrelated murder. I found him to be a very interesting character.
Can you imagine the boldness and the just amazing cleverness it would take to fake your identity like that and pretend you were somebody like that? That's just...
He was quite successful at it, too, which was really... He traveled in, you know, a very high society that you would think could recognize a fake, and he carried it off.
Well, apparently people are attracted to celebrity, whether they're real or not.
Right.
I think you actually mentioned the Kardashians in your book, didn't you?
I think it was just a passing.
I know, yeah. But you mentioned them. I noticed that.
Yeah.
I did read your book.
Good. Thank you.
What kind of a response have you gotten? I know the book just came out.
Well, it just came out on Tuesday, but so far the reviews have been good, and I'm really excited about it, and yeah.
Well, it's always fun to talk about crime novels. I consume them like potato chips. And a few years ago, well, I guess it's more recently, about a year ago, I read a crime novel written by a prosecutor. And I'm not going to say her name, but she had a scene in the novel where her prosecutor protagonist is going out to a car after eating dinner in New York City, and it's dark, and suddenly a bicycle comes racing by, and the rider of the bicycle is able to light a Molotov cocktail and hit her car as he sped by. And I stopped dead. I said, how is this possible that this guy could light a Molotov cocktail while going by in total darkness at a high speed? And it just stopped me. And I kind of lost respect for the story because of that. How do you make it real?
Well, it's a challenge to keep it real and keep it entertaining, because sometimes you have to heighten reality in order for it to be interesting. So to me, it's the question is not has it happened to, you know, whoever, but could it happen? And that's sort of my measure. Because a lot of lawyers will say sometimes, well, I've never seen that happen, you know, if you write something about a courtroom. But that doesn't mean it couldn't happen, and that doesn't make it unbelievable. And that's my mark.
Well, Pam, thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure having you on the program.
Thanks so much.
My guest has been Pamela Wexler. Her new novel is The Fens for the Book Nook. I'm Vic McCunis.